Now, more and more teachers in Wisconsin are changing jobs. According to a new report from the nonpartisan Wisconsin Policy Forum, turnover among teachers rose to just under 16% during the last school year. That rate included both the highest levels on record of teachers moving between districts and the second highest levels of teachers leaving classrooms in Wisconsin's public schools. The Policy Forum analysis found that turnover was highest in districts that serve lower-income students, and it was highest among teachers of color. Among other things, there's concern that this kind of turnover can lead to inconsistency and instability in the classroom at a time when many students are still feeling ripple effects from pandemic learning loss. We're learning more about what might be driving high teacher turnover, what impact it's having, and what districts might be able to do about it. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you seeing this kind of teacher turnover in your local school district? What do you think is behind that? If you're a teacher yourself, have you recently changed jobs or left the profession altogether? Share your experience. Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Gardner Seawright is an assistant professor in the Department of Educational Foundations at UW-Whitewater and a former middle school teacher. Gardner, welcome to Central Time.
Happy to be here.
We've been hearing some concerns about teacher retention over the years, but at least according to this report, we've seen this jump. What do you think might be behind that?
I think there's a lot of things that could be behind it. I think, you know, looking at the trends over time is really important here, especially considering that, like, this is not entirely new and not entirely surprising given the trends over time, considering that there's been a relatively high rate of turnover just over the last 10 years. But then it is quite concerning that it jumped to the high rate of for 2023. So I am concerned about it, but I think the things that we are seeing that are leading to it, I think it's weird to start off, is really important to kind of deal with the popular presumption that turnover like this is kind of from out of control students and resentful teachers of those out of control students. But recent research, including the policy brief that just came out, really points to poor working conditions, organizational culture, and dissatisfaction as central contributors to turnover. And it's not really the fault of students.
Before we dig it more into the causes, let's talk about the consequences. I think the expectation is schools are mostly going to end up with the staffing they need, might be down to the wire. Does it affect students if there's a higher level of turnover in the staff that's showing up in the classrooms from year to year?
100%. You know, that is the real problem here. It's like, yes, we are concerned about, you know, teachers are workers, and we want them to have positive, supportive working environments. But at the end of the day, the people who feel the brunt of teacher turnover are the students. And so, and especially in the districts where we need the most experienced teachers, that's where we're seeing these highest turnover rates. In those districts, students are hurting because of this rate, because you are having fewer teachers with the amount of experience needed to teach, like from an asset-based perspective, from a community-driven perspective, who have like a trauma-informed idea of how to work with students who are going through things like a major pandemic. So there is also just like a bulk of research showing that there are negative learning outcomes from high teacher turnover and just high teacher stress.
My mom is a retired teacher. She taught in my district for many, many years. Some of the students who graduated with me from high school, well, they came back and taught there, and she was the one training them. How much do we lose if we don't have that, at least a core of long-term teachers sharing that institutional knowledge with the next generation?
Well, the institutional knowledge is key, right? But one of the hard things here is that sharing in that institutional knowledge is not always formalized. So we don't have as many formal mentorship programs that we should have, especially in the districts that need kind of a specific set of teaching skills, like working in our city districts and our urban districts with our students who might be experiencing assortments of trauma in their lives.
Gardner C. Wright is with us from the Department of Educational Foundations at UW-Whitewater. Looking at this new report showing a jump in turnover among teachers in Wisconsin's public schools, moving either from one school to another or moving from teaching in a classroom to doing something different altogether, you can join in at 800-642-1234. As a parent or student in a district, are you seeing a lot of new unfamiliar faces showing up because of this? If you work in schools, what's your experience there? What do you think is behind this? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Gardner, you laid out a short list of some of the possible causes of this kind of turnover, including working conditions for teachers in schools. What kind of concerns that you do you have that could be driving this level of turnover?
So in terms of working conditions, you have to look at, yes, like the kind of baseline, like what are the facilities like? You know, MPS, like Milwaukee Public Schools, is in dire need of some kind of facilities upgrades. There's a lot of schools that don't have basic air conditioning, and that's across the state. So, you know, there are the basic things that additional funding from the legislature could help. But you also have things like how the organizational structure of schools, and there's actually a lot of research that the organizational structure actually matters more than a lot of other factors. So things like how much are teachers actually listen to? How much input do they have in the decision-making process? How much do their administration leaders actually listen to them? What influence do they have over their curriculum? What kind of autonomy do they have in the classroom? You know, we've over the last, you know, couple of decades of educational policy reform, we've seen a really teacher autonomy become more and more constricted. And I think you see a lot of teacher frustration just in like in that they don't have the time to do really creative and exciting things in their classroom. And there are fewer opportunities to have autonomy in their classroom the way they should and kind of treated like the professional that they are.
A concern I remember hearing in the past, Gardner, is that, you know, you might have some well-funded school district, maybe in a growing suburban area, the tax base is increasing, the number of students is going up. They can afford to pay a teacher more than, say, a rural district where you're seeing lower student enrollment. And, you know, if a teacher wants to make a little more to progress in their career, they might not be able to do it within that small district. So they head to this hypothetical example, the wealthier suburban district. Is that part of the story here?
So that is part. So direct compensation, at least in Wisconsin, it doesn't really shake out that way. Because Milwaukee Public Schools is the highest paying district in the state. It might be really close with Madison. But where the disparity lies between suburban districts and city districts is in the resources that they're able to provide. So the disparity in funding doesn't necessarily come down to direct compensation in terms of salary, but in terms of like what type of donations can wealthy community members give in terms of like physical facilities or fundraisers that go directly to fund clubs and extra activities. So that's where you see a lot of the disparities show up. And ultimately, those are like really important parts of an educational experience. And they also, when students have a lot of things going on, that ultimately that gives teachers more to work with as well.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Joe is with us in Spooner. Joe, hi.
Yeah, hi there. I taught for 24 years in a suburb of Minneapolis, St. Louis Park School District. It was my second career. I'm a retired Marine Corps officer also and decided to go into public education. I taught English. In 2013, I took a leave of absence and went and taught in China for 3 years. And when I came back, the culture of my building had changed dramatically. Cell phones had proliferated throughout. There were liberal policies, and I use that term very loosely because I consider myself a progressive, policies that really policies of the generic terms of under the guidance of equity and diversity, and I support those, but those issues supplanted what really was essential, and that was the rigorous curriculum that I experienced before I went to China. And when I came back, that went out the window, and the whole building focus became about socio-emotional aspects of children and teaching them about alternative histories and things like that, rather than, you know, straight up ABCs, teaching reading and writing and staying focused on a rigorous curriculum, because I think that's the most equitable thing of all.
Joe, thanks a lot for the call. Gardner, Joe, worried about changes he saw there, and I imagine there are a lot of teachers one way or another who may not like the way that the trends in teaching go over time.
Yeah, and then, so Joe's experience there is, you know, he hit on a lot of major factors that are under debate right now, and I think what he's talking about with kind of like classic rigorous curriculum, I want to focus on that for a second, because that is that's been a point of conversation that's been frequently touted in the current kind of debates around equity, diversity, and inclusion, and that's where I think we have to think about what is rigorous. And that's where, you know, there's a kind of classic style of kind of that is focused more on rote engagement. Okay, memorize these dates, these facts, these timetables, these kind of formulas, and it is focused on that rote memorization and regurgitation on high stakes standardized tests, where we tend alongside kind of a push for more equity-based curriculum, culturally relevant curriculum, you also see a push for a more critical in-depth engagement with specific topics. And that does look different. It does not, it's not the same kind of super fast-paced engagement with lesson after lesson after lesson, where you're supposed to remember a specific set of facts. But there's a lot of research supporting that kind of in-depth engagement with materials that does look a little different actually promotes more long-term retention, more critical thinking, and it ultimately has positive results for like what we want out of students. But ultimately, I think it really comes down to like big philosophical questions of like, what do we think the purpose of education is? And what do you hope students are going to get? Do you want them to have this kind of list of facts, or do you want them to be deep critical thinkers?
Joe, thanks a lot for sharing your experience. We're talking to UW-Whitewater education professor Gardner C. Wright about turnover among teachers in Wisconsin. It's up, according to a recent report. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think school districts could do, should do to retain teachers? Do you want to see more from the state legislature and the governor on this? If you're a current or former educator yourself, love to hear what you've seen. Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. We're picking up our talk with Gardner C. Wright, assistant professor in the Department of Educational Foundations at UW-Whitewater, looking at the turnover rate for teachers in Wisconsin, why it has gone up, what impact that can have, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think is driving teachers to leave districts, to leave teaching? Are we talking about you? Tell us about your story at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Back to your calls now. Jack is with us in Spring Lake, Michigan. Jack, hi.
Hi, how are you, sir?
Good. What'd you want to tell us about?
Well, my name's Dr. Jack Drennan, PhD hypnotherapy, master's psychology, master's education, and the first thing, always a teacher. Just because you have a piece of paper doesn't mean you're any good at what you do. But moving from there to the students, I started teaching in inner city Detroit. And I grew up in a tough inner city family with a military dad. And as I taught, I found out, and I later moved to a suburban school because they recruited me. Not I recruited them, but I found out that after a couple years, I needed to go back and get a master's in psychology. And because the number, I would have 40 students in my class, overload, and the other teacher teaching the same thing would have 15. Now, what was the difference? The difference is every student wrote down everything they felt I needed to know about them on the first day of class. Second thing, I was always at the door and thanking them for coming to school. Your goal is for day one is for students to look forward to coming to day two and day three and day four. So we did crazy things. They got all their homework done. They hit me in the face with three pies.
Jack, thanks for the call. Jack, it sounds like Gardner, it sounds like Jack put a lot of heart and soul into his teaching. What is it that we need to do to have teachers prepared for maybe a difficult situation, whether it's an inner city school district, as Jack said, or a lot of students? Do we have enough preparation in there for them, getting hit in the pie notwithstanding?
So I think there's two things that are really important to underlying that story. And first is that he went back to get his master's degree. That type of thing needs to have formal support. So things like state tuition reimbursements for new teachers going through initial teacher education, but going back and seeking additional credentials. That is such a huge bonus for districts that we as a state, we should really be supporting more options to fund teachers to improve their skill set. But then on the backside of just him having that heart and trying to do that, and that actually reminds me of another part of the report that we're talking about today, that Black teachers and teachers of a color are overrepresented in turnover. And the reasons for this are the same as the others, but that there's a lot of stress in teaching, but there's also for a lot of teachers of color, there is additional uncompensated labor forced attached to the work that they do with students of color. So this is when you have a Black teacher come in, there is both an explicit and implicit assumption that they're going to serve as mentors, de facto counselors, community liaisons, disciplinarians, curriculum specialists for Black and Brown communities across the state. That is an additional amount of work that we need to recognize that increases burnout because they are bringing an additional skill set, because there's also a tremendous amount of research identifying the positive academic achievements attached to having a more diverse workforce. When teachers come in and are able to see the strengths and the assets of the communities that they're working with, that goes a long way to working with students so they can create lessons and engage them in ways where they are excited to come into class every day. And that's huge. And what I'm saying is that we need to find formal ways to compensate those skill sets and the additional labor that we put on Black teachers and teachers of color.
Thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. Elizabeth joins us now in Madison. Elizabeth, hi.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call. I just retired as a teacher of the deaf and hard of hearing after 41 years and have seen a lot of changes, big changes in Wisconsin that I think contribute to burnout. Teacher burnout is, we have a new teacher evaluation system where teachers now get not only observed, but we have to upload documents. We have to comment on documents. It's like a whole extra process that teachers have to add in addition to their load of teaching and a lot of requirements from the Department of Public Instruction I wish some of these people would actually go into a school and see what, is involved. Also, the population of students has changed. There's parental support may not be as high as it was back in the day. I think people, the general public, think that kids come to school, they get their breakfast, they have a lovely home life, everything is fine and dandy. That is not the case with a lot of students. So these students are coming with a lot of trauma, especially after COVID. There's just a lot being put on teachers.
Elizabeth, I got you. We don't have a ton of time left, but thanks for sharing your experience. Gardner, Elizabeth pointing to, it's not just standing up in front of the class and teaching. It's a lot of back-end bureaucracy that we don't see, she says, and a lot of challenges with the students themselves in some cases.
You know, I think, yeah, there's two things going on there, and like the back-end bureaucracy is one thing, and yes, and I want to come back to that, but I think, like, yeah, like students are dealing with a lot of trauma, including, you know, a global pandemic that we're both coming back from. And I think, you know, teachers do need to be better prepared with trauma-informed approaches of like how to work with students who have been experiencing things like a loss of a loved one, or even dealing with the trauma associated with structural racism or poverty. These are all sources of trauma that teachers need to be prepared to kind of work with students to and support them while they're dealing with that in schools. And basically, you know, students come into a classroom with a lot of life behind them, and I think teachers need to be prepared to do that. And there needs to be also administrative support once they are teachers to engage that kind of stuff. But to our caller's point about like the teaching evaluation systems, I think it's actually a good point to consider when it comes to actually the presence of unions in districts across the country. So there's a significant amount of research pointing out that in districts with a high density of teacher unionization, I actually have fewer amounts of stress. And I bring this up because if you think about the point around teacher evaluation systems as part of collective bargaining agreements, you teachers can have say over those type of evaluation system. That's part of the whole system. And so, you know, so there's some good research showing that unionization actually reduces teacher stress, as well as compensating, like additional salary compensation. In Wisconsin, teacher salary has kind of adjusted for inflation has kind of decreased 8% since the passage of Act 10. So I think there's like in terms of how the public, as well as administrators and policymakers, can support teachers, there's always the option of like how can we move forward and reconsider teacher unionization.
And we'll leave it there. Thanks to our guest Gardner Seawright from UW-Whitewater with us today to look at why Wisconsin is seeing a record high for turnover among teachers. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up today at 6 on 1A+, get answers to lots of questions about former President Trump's growing list of criminal indictments. That's today at 6 on 1A+. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about the magic of childhood baseball fields.
There are so many activities that define summertime as a kid. Maybe it's running through a sprinkler, trips to the library, playing tag through the neighbor's yard. For writer Ron Weber, it was playing baseball, something he looks back on with deeply fond memories.
It comes as the snow melts in mid-March and the ground is dried by wind and sunshine. On those early warm days, as the sun continues riding a little higher on its daily arc, I am referring to a season that for me as a kid was most important of all, baseball. I was lucky enough to have grown up when baseball was unquestionably America's pastime. After a long winter, it was time for the only game that really mattered. We often endured a two-week period in which the clay soils dried out by playing catch or wiffle ball on any patch of dry ground we could find. Eventually came the day to play ball. When I was 8, my 13-year-old brother Rick and a few other neighborhood kids had decided to reclaim a roughly one-acre patch of fallow field on our property in Kenosha County, bordered by a country road and rows of spruce trees lining the remaining three sides. We cut the long grasses and weeds from the field using push lawnmowers, which for the first pass had to be tilted up to mow. As the youngest, I was relegated to raking detail, removing as much of the cut grass as I could before the next pass cut the grass shorter and shorter. Looking at the cut field surrounded by those spruce is when I believe the dreams began. It didn't matter the number of players. We played for hours and hours all through the summer, the start of the school year, all that could stop us. A backstop and two benches were built using scrap lumber. The bases were old boat cushions. There was talk of putting up lights, but the cruel reality of the number of lights that would be needed nixed that idea. We were a bunch of kids who wanted a ball field, so we made one. Each time I took the field there, I hit like Mickey Mantle, covered the outfield like Willie Mays, and pitched like Don Drysdale. I went to school to learn, to church to pray, and to this field to dream. At 11, I started playing in a league at another field run by the township, about 3 miles from my house. That field became my new field of dreams. The lights, scoreboard, and outfield fence, making the big leagues seem even a more real probability. Teams were named after major league teams, and I played for the Brewers. Now it was their emerging star, Robin Yount, that I emulated. As I turned 15, he was a superstar, but he still played the game like one is supposed to.
Yount.
Like a kid.
Makes a great catch, and Rodney Amos has thrown the first no-hitter in Milwaukee Brewer history on a great game-ending catch by Robin Yount.
Playing on that field was as close as I ever got to the big leagues. I guess that is a story for just about every kid who picks up a glove and bat and happens to dream. I can't complain, though. I had a good 10-year run as a would-be major leaguer. My career nowadays is relegated to a once-a-year softball tournament, in which I still try to play like I always have, like Robin Yount, like a kid. The field we built has been gone for decades now, reclaimed by grasses, weeds, and eventually offspring of the spruce that once lined our field. No sign remains of our handiwork or the countless hours a generation of kids spent there. On a recent trip back home, I drove past the second field of dreams from my teens. I was shocked to see it grown up in long grasses and weeds. The light poles, scoreboard, and fences reminded me of tombstones in an unkempt cemetery. Encroaching development of an ever-expanding city had claimed another victim. It mattered little to me what part of our bigger and better society this place was slated to become. No, in my mind, both would remain what they had always been. Places for kids, fields of dreams.
Ron Weber is a writer who lives in Weyerhaeuser. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Want to make sure you catch every Wisconsin Life story? Subscribe to our podcast. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Now, as depression rates in the U.S. reach new highs, some patients find that common treatments like therapy and or antidepressants aren't effective for them. That's leading a push for new research into alternate forms of treatment, including psychoactive drugs. In Wisconsin, a growing number of clinics have popped up in recent months offering an alternative form of treatment with the drug ketamine. Ketamine has long been approved by the FDA as an anesthetic, but more recently, researchers have experimented with using dosages to elicit a hallucinogenic effect aimed at treating a variety of mental health issues. The FDA has not approved the use of ketamine for this purpose. Many insurance companies won't cover it for mental health treatment. Our next guest researches the use of a variety of psychoactive drugs in mental health settings, and you could join in at 800-642-1234. Have you seen these ketamine clinics opening up in your area? What do you think about the use of ketamine for mental health treatment? Do you have questions about how it could work? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. Cody Wenther is an assistant professor at UW-Madison School of Pharmacy, where he's the director of the Psychoactive Pharmaceutical Investigation Master's Program. His lab researches new therapeutic treatments for mental health care, including opioids, psychedelics, and cannabinoids. Cody, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me.
Ketamine, I think, is not necessarily a household word for a lot of people. Cody, can you tell us a little bit about what it is and what it does?
Certainly. So ketamine is a compound that acts on a relatively lesser known neurotransmitter, glutamate. Despite glutamate being the major excitatory neurotransmitter in your brain. So when your neurons are talking to one another, that's largely a glutamate dependent function. And ketamine is a compound that blocks a receptor for this glutamate neurotransmitter. And because of that, found great use and continues to find great use as an anesthetic agent in following surgery, for example. That same mechanism is what folks are now using and exploring for the antidepressant treatments that were being mentioned earlier.
How much research has gone into ketamine so far as an antidepressant treatment?
Yeah, there's actually been a good amount of research sponsored by large funders like the National Institute of Mental Health, starting around the turn of the century or this millennium in the early 2000s. people started noticing that ketamine was having rapid acting effects on people's mood when they were getting infusions of ketamine for other approaches. And this set off a wave of research, not just in people, but also to look at the mechanisms in cells and other models to understand what was going on. And one of the things that they found quite interesting is that one of the ways in which your brain manifests, you know, learning and changes is that neurons that are normally talking to one another will wire together fairly closely. And as your brain learns, it undergoes a process called plasticity, where old connections may weaken, new connections may form and strengthen. And ketamine seemed to be modifying those connections and helping induce that neuroplasticity. So that went on for a period of about 20 years that finally culminated in the approval of a particular form of ketamine called S-ketamine being approved as a adjunct or add-on treatment for depression where people hadn't found relief, so-called treatment-resistant depression, in 2019. And that's available as a nasal spray. But because that spray has a lot of restrictions around its use, it can be quite costly. And ketamine has been available since approximately the 70s. Other individuals started saying that thinking that they might want to use the original formulation of ketamine as a intravenous form or others. And that's kind of what we started seeing in those clinics that are coming up today.
When I've talked to people about treating depression, it seems like, you know, for some people, an antidepressant, an existing antidepressant might work great. For some people, it might work kind of, some not at all. Talk therapy might work, be lovely for one person, not help another. How important is it to find new things for our toolkit so the people who do slip through the cracks, the other things don't work for, might have an option?
I would argue it's very important. We don't want to leave people behind when people are suffering. And we're having particularly high rates of suicidality in the world today and epidemic rates of depression and other psychiatric illnesses. And you're exactly right. The numbers seem to indicate that about a third of individuals will have a good response from first-line antidepressants. These are things like selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors that folks may have heard of. About a third then will experience relief when another treatment is added on or their therapy is switched. But there's about a third of individuals who go through all the medication treatments available, some of the procedural treatments, talk therapy, as you mentioned, and they aren't experiencing significant relief. So I think addressing that fairly large proportion of individuals with new therapies is very important. And I think the other thing that's really interesting about ketamine and potentially beneficial is that rapid acting nature of it. So in comparison to those first line antidepressants, which often take 6 to 8 weeks to work, often folks who do experience relief from ketamine, which is somewhere around 2/3 to 3/4 of folks who try it, they get relief within hours to days. So I think it represents an important new area. It's sort of a new type of mechanism, as I mentioned, looking at glutamate rather than serotonin, which might help us improve it further. But we definitely don't want to be leaving people behind.
To the extent people might have heard of ketamine in the past, it might be as a party drug, so-called, something that people used illicitly. Are there concerns about abuse, about downsides of ketamine?
Yes, certainly. There are potential downsides to all drugs that we use. As a pharmacist, a neuropharmacologist, I like to remind people, you know, it's the dose that makes the poison for all compounds, and getting the right drug in the right place at the right time is vitally important, because any one of those things going wrong can cause there to be problems. And ketamine is a so-called scheduled drug. So underneath the Controlled Substances Act, compounds that have a risk of abuse have special protections on how they're handled and used. And ketamine falls roughly in the middle of that range, which means that it has a known abuse liability or risk, but that it's not quite as high as something that has the highest risk, things like cocaine or some very strong opioids, for example. And so the things to watch out for with ketamine are it can cause that sedation. It does cause a sensation that people often refer to as dissociation, where they feel like they're sort of floating or outside of their body. And at higher doses, some people describe this as sort of psychedelic-like. And for those reasons, it's definitely needs to be administered under close supervision. And we don't want folks just taking it and then operating heavy machinery, for example. That's part of the notion of why ketamine is a scheduled compound, and part of the reasons that it is misused. And it does continue to be misused by people outside of therapeutic contexts. And I would note that for folks who get that dose wrong, there is a risk of coma and even death. So it's not a compound to be treated lightly or as if it has no significant risks.
We're talking to UW-Madison School of Pharmacy Professor Cody Wenther about ketamine as a mental health treatment with new clinics popping up around Wisconsin. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions, your thoughts on this. Do you think clinics should offer ketamine as a treatment option, even if that treatment isn't yet approved by the FDA? What kind of regulations or oversight do you think there should be? Have you or someone near you tried this? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with Cody Wenther, assistant professor at UW-Madison School of Pharmacy, who researches psychedelics, cannabinoids, and alternative treatment options for mental health. With us today to look at why more clinics around Wisconsin are starting to offer ketamine in an attempt to treat depression and other mental health concerns. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts or questions or maybe your experiences. Let's go to your calls now. Peter is with us in Pewaukee. Peter, hello.
Hello, Rob and Cody. I'm happy to be on the radio to report that my daughter is going in for a ketamine clinic, not only diagnosis, but treatment at the end of October. All of the clinicians in this clinic seem to be very concerned with basically the patient's health, whether the therapy is going to work. And there is a five-step process that they put them through to make sure that they have success. They want the patient to have success. So that's why the process is so long. She started out at the end of July, and she won't have the actual therapy until the end of October. But all of this takes time to evaluate the patient in order for it to be safe. And I want everybody to understand that clinics are really trying to do this right.
Peter, thanks a lot for the call. Hoping for success on that treatment for your daughter. Cody, Peter feels good about this experience so far. There are concerns, though. This is not an FDA-approved use of this drug and not necessarily a lot of guidelines and oversight on how it actually gets used for patients like Peter's daughter.
Yeah, I'm also very happy to hear that Peter feels like his daughter's getting the help that she needs and feeling comfortable with the process. I would say for other folks looking at ketamine clinics that, like other healthcare decisions, right, getting a first and second opinion and helping yourself understand how well the clinicians understand the medications they're working with is really important. And I would say it's especially important in the case of what would in this case be called an off-label use. And regarding the FDA approval piece, I want to point out that off-label use is not really outside of the norm in psychiatry. That is, you know, it can cost hundreds of millions of dollars for a pharmaceutical company to run a clinical trial to get an approval for a particular condition. And through clinical experience, often clinicians will find that a medication is useful for something adjacent to or slightly different than that indication. Sometimes the pharmaceutical companies will then go and seek that indication so they can get insurance coverage for it. Sometimes they will not. But it does create one less layer of oversight on how the product is being used. And so the thing I would say about ketamine on this front is it's made up of two molecules that are mirror images of one another, like your left hand and right hand. And so the version that's only the left-hand version is the one that's approved as a nasal spray for treatment-resistant depression. It's the one that has both the left and right hand mirror forms that is being used off-label. So while it's not FDA approved for that, it's not like there's no evidence base or this is just completely made up. There's certainly good reason for folks to have made this next step, but it does demand obviously additional care because of the different route of administration and the fact that not always do those left-hand and right-hand molecules act identically.
Peter, thanks a lot for that call. Time for one more caller. Mary is with us in Wind Lake. Mary, hello.
Hi. I called in because my daughter actually gets these treatments. She started last May. And just before that, I was watching the news, and there was a gentleman, a vet, who had not been able to work and was suicidal and all these things. And then we met with this clinic in Wauwatosa. And again, like the previous caller, they, you know, they sit you down and they go through all your medical history. And the treatment itself for my daughter is IV, but she has her therapist on Zoom with her, and I'm always in there with her too, and we walk through it. But I can tell you a little bit, my daughter.
Well, just briefly, Mary, we're just about out of time. Yeah. How is it working out for your daughter so far?
Oh, my God. It's been life-saving. She was in and out of the hospital, suicide attempts, unable to work, unable to complete school. It was 10 years of just, can't even tell you. And this, I have my daughter back. She's got a great job. She can call in. She's married now. I mean, life changing.
Fantastic. Mary, thank you so much for sharing that. Glad to hear it. And just our last few moments, Cody, are you hopeful for that, more of that kind of story?
Very hopeful and very glad to hear it. I think ketamine is sort of the first wave of the next layer of investigations for psychedelic-assisted therapies in general. There's still a lot more to learn, but the stories where people are really having those life-changing moments and able to re-engage and live the life that they want to are truly incredible. Not everybody's going to be a success, but it's amazing to see those that are.
Mary, thanks for sharing that story. And Cody, thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
That's Cody Wenther, assistant professor at UW-Madison School of Pharmacy, where he directs the Psychoactive Pharmaceutical Investigation Master's Program. He's with us today for a look at the drug ketamine as a possible treatment for depression and why more ketamine clinics are opening across the state. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, from cities to small towns, a lot of communities all over the United States have seen a jump in homelessness. If everybody has this local problem, do we need national solutions? We'll hear from a group that aims to find and implement those solutions. And sometimes healthcare providers overlook symptoms reported by patients, including levels of pain. If you're the patient in that situation, you can advocate for yourself. We'll get some advice. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time.